If you're enjoying this podcast, please leave us a review and tap the follow button so that you never miss an episode.
Hey, everybody. Welcome back to another Monday, the best night of the week. And you know what that means? It's time for another episode of RFRX, your prescription for coping. I'm your host, Kara, and I have with me this evening the returning, the fantastic, the amazing, fearless sidekick, sometimes misheard as fearless psychic, Helen Green. Helen, how are you doing?
I am doing wonderful. After last week, and we're now into 2023, back to doing this, like, I'm so happy that Mondays actually get me, like, things actually get me excited for Mondays, because usually Monday, I'm like, fuck this shit. So the fact that we're back to doing this makes me so happy. So I hope all of you are having a wonderful day. Happy MLK Day to all of our wonderful listeners and participants. Thank you so much for being here. So Kara,
yes,
what are you going to do this week?
Besides be here at RFRX with you fine people, I am going to be working as normal. I'm also getting ready for our fun and exciting meeting that we're going to be having this weekend that Dr. Ray is going to mention later. So that's going to be fun. And yeah, I'm generally a boring person. That might be it. What are you doing?
Well, I'm finishing up my job. So I gave myself a 3-day weekend this weekend. So I'm super stoked for that. And I start my new job on Monday. So that's exciting. I'm also going to be at this really special meeting that y'all need to know about. And Dr. Ray and a few of us will talk a little bit more about later. So other than my normal boring life, I have little peaks of excitement.
And that's what
that is adulthood.
Yes.
Monday, little piece of excitement. Monday. Yeah.
And some of those little peaks of excitement are things like Zoom meetings.
Right. But, welcome to Zoom meetings.
Life in 2023. What can you do?
Yes, exactly.
But I am enjoying it, and I'm glad you're here, and I'm glad all of these other fine people are here.
So I'm going to introduce our wonderful guests. Cynthia is a social worker in the city of Chicago. She authors a blog called freedmenhealthandwellness.com, which I hope Cara will link in the description, which speaks on the social determinants of health of Black Americans that descend from child slavery. She has been a guest on several podcasts and is a regular host on the nonprofits produced by the Atheist Community of Austin and Women Atheists Unload, produced by Secular Haven Channel. Cynthia is also a health and political advocate that works with the NAASD, By People Media, and is the newest lead organizer of the Black Nonbelievers in Chicago chapter, also known as BN Chi Town. Woo! She works with these groups to achieve social and economic justice for Black freedom descendants, push for health equality for marginalized groups, and to normalize atheism in the Black community. Cynthia is also a musician that writes and performs a variety of genres of music and is a member of the Freedom from Religions Godless Gospel. And this girl's got a voice. So anyway, welcome, Cynthia. Thank you for coming and being part of us, part of our little group tonight.
Thank you for having me.
We are so excited to have you on. When Helen told me that she was going to ask you, I was like, there's no way she's not going to do it. And here you are. And I'm so excited. Hooray.
I appreciate it, because it was such last minute. And the fact that you would be here tonight just makes it. It makes my soul happy.
this is proof that Jesus exists, right?
You're doing the God's work. I'm telling you.
Hold on, I think we're having technical difficulties. Everyone's been muted. You can see patterns anywhere, right?
Right, exactly.
I love it. But yeah, we are certainly blessed to have you on with us this evening in the most secular sense. And I know you have a lot going on. You have an impressive resume. Tell us, what have you been up to lately?
Oh my goodness. So as of late, I have been doing mostly wrapping up my previous social work position because I got laid off. Yeah, that sucks. Yeah. And however, I've been very much so involved with the union there. We just finished a 3-day strike. And I got a chance to talk to a lot of the news outlets, including NPR, CBS, ABC, Chicago Tribune, the Chicago Reader, just a lot of them, just discussing what the layoffs in of itself are going to do to the communities that I service. I was laid off with like 61 other people. Yeah.
That's gross.
Yeah. And the crazy thing about it is that it happened like right after we unionized. So yeah.
Funny that.
Yeah.
Sounds like retaliation.
Yeah. Yeah. Sounds like an unfair labor practice to me, you know, which is illegal. So yeah. So right now I have time on my hands, right? But instead of just like, you know, eating like a lot of bonbons and watching, you know, different soap operas, which people were swearing I was going to do, even though I am in the process of binging Andromeda, don't judge me, but I am. I also wanted to make sure that my time was spent doing something productive. So that would be going back into writing on my blog. I was doing like posts here and there because like between working and doing, you know, speaking engagements last year, and now becoming the newest lead affiliate organizer in Chicago for Black Nonbelievers. Shout out to Nandisa Thomas, who is in the chat right now. Hey girl, how you doing? I just want to make sure that even though like that particular chapter at that place is like halted for right now, the advocacy work does not stop. You know, one of the things that we highlighted a lot during the strike, and especially like when I was talking to these different media places, was that my patient population specifically was cis and transgender women and young people. And the predominant demographic that I worked with were Black, cis, and trans women. So even though I had like some I had some transgender white women, I had a couple of seniors, and I had like young people who were cisgender male, mostly MSM. But the ones who stayed with me longer, because the young people will eventually age out when they turn 25. So MSM, not MSN, MSM, you know, men having sex with men. So but they would age out by the time that they got to 25. So the cis and transgender women were the ones who stayed under my particular arc, I guess that you can call it, or caseload for that time period, where I was attaching them to different resources, whether it was the helping them with making sure that they got medication, because all of my patients were living with HIV. So I would attach them to different patient assistance programs in order for them to be able to afford their medication or get their medication completely for free, attach them to medical insurance, because sometimes when they started working with me, they may not have had medical insurance. A big social determinant of health, which we'll get into later on, was housing. A lot of my patients that I saw, especially who happened to be Black, whether they were cis or trans, would be unstably housed or street-based. So, you know, one of the main, you know, issues, like especially like when we would do like initial assessments or even do reassessments with them, is like, how can we get you attached to housing? And with them being unstably housed or street-based, of course, like they're at like the federal poverty line or below. So it was even more so a task, a Herculean task at times, to attach them to housing, especially if they had little to no income. So, I mean, I was providing a lot of those particular resources, and it was something that I felt was a mission that I chose for myself, especially because I got a chance to service a community that I'm very passionate about. You know, I'm very passionate about Black folk and I'm very passionate about queer folk. I have been an ally to the LGBTQIA plus community for a long time. And even like started to become more of an ally even when I was a theist. So I wanted to see about, you know, really looking into that intersectionality between race and gender identification and sexual orientation, and even like some of the other barriers that, you know, they would face as a community, and see if we can help knock some of those barriers down. So when the layoffs came about, I was like, what are the patients going to do now? And this is something that I addressed a lot, especially like going through different interviews and also being on the picket line, when you are taking away different services like case management, and one of the biggest services that was decimated was behavioral health, you are taking away a big chunk of what is going to help people become whole. And a big portion, especially when it comes to health, is ignoring of how important behavioral health is. It's like so important. Like if you can't, I know I hate to quote the Bible, but I am. The Bible says, turn with me in your pages, when the head is sick, the whole body is sick. Yeah. And the thing about it is that if you're not addressing some of the behavioral health issues that our patients are dealing with, then you're also going to have issues specifically with their, you know, physical health as well. Because how people are behaving, and even, and we can even like look at like utilizing like substance use in order to be a way to kind of not necessarily deal with some of the issues, or especially trauma that happen to be so prevalent, whether if it is environmental trauma, childhood trauma that they carried into their adulthood, or even like trauma that's even based in discrimination, bias, and racism. All of those particular issues are so prevalent, so real, and they need addressing even in that particular space. So taking away all these different things, especially from an organization that touted racial equity, trauma-informed care, LGBTQIA plus liberation, and all the buzzwords that we hear nowadays, it was quite devastating. And I was more so concerned, not necessarily about me. I mean, like, I'm employable, I can get another job. But, you know, it became personal to me because I looked at my patients as that's my community, and I'm no longer there to service them. And when, and so I'm more so like, I want to make sure that people who are absolutely in these particular communities that are marginalized historically have like outlets where they can garner on to resources. Another portion of social determinants of health was like, you know, service supporting institutions and organizations that are there for marginalized communities. I mean, we see them pop up, but sometimes they don't always have all the resources that one may need in order for them to live a more holistic life. So as much as like that one person like myself can be a conduit in order for them to be able to get the assistance that they need in different places that they can get it, and making sure that they're being able to access these services on more than one occasion was the mission that I set forward to do. And it was kind of like my way of picking up some of the legacy points that Dr. King left behind.
It's really interesting what you said, because about like the intersectionality of where you're working, meeting these groups of people, especially in behavioral health, like that's always the first thing that get cut, unfortunately.
Oh yeah.
Like one of my really good friends, he is a behavioral analysis for one of the local mental health chapters, and they had to show financially how mental health care to youth was going to save the state money in the future to get more funding into mental health programs and to that money to be allocated from the Florida government to those programs. Mm-hmm. Like they had, it wasn't so much about the mental health. It was like, this will save us money in the future if we do it now, you know? And what you're saying about hitting those pockets of people, you know, in dealing with mental health, dealing with health crises, because health crisis will always lead to mental health crisis. It's just, because we're human beings and that's what happens. So the fact that you're, you know, doing, you know, the harder work of actually striking and showing and doing the work to say like, hey, this is wrong, we need to take care of each other, is something to really be admired. Because like, you know, you're kind of going, to use a Bible story, you are David going up against the Goliath. So, you know, so that's something to really, so through that process, what are you learning as you're kind of working on that advocacy between, you know, not only being a person of color, but also dealing with the mental health aspect of that as well? Like, what are things that you're learning and finding out about by doing that work?
I would say that doing that work is showing that it is largely more ignored than what I realized. I remember specifically having a conversation with a really good friend of mine a few years ago, and we were talking about how prevalent secrets are in our families. We don't necessarily want to talk about if uncle such and such touched nephew such and such inappropriately, or niece such and such inappropriately, or if cousin said something and did this, that, and the third. And a lot of times people will hold on to those traumas or try to bury it. It didn't happen. I don't want to talk about it. And it starts to bleed into every portion of their lives. And when I would talk with some of my patients about their mood, because that's part of like the assessment process, you know, we would sometimes start to unearth traumas from years and years and years and years. And it started to force me to look into how much more prevalent is this issue, specifically in the Black community, than is talked about. And searching through my different studies and guides and, you know, going to different Adobe Acrobat readers and what have you, it's something that was said that if you were to seek counseling for, or even want to talk to a professional about this particular topic, then it's not, it was frowned upon. You know, it's like, no, we don't talk about these things outside of family. And even within the family, we keep that on the hush hush. And it's like, how do you heal if you don't necessarily address these issues that are coming into your life over and over again? I remember specifically, I had a patient who was trans and she had a cocaine habit. We were discussing, because we were a harm reduction organization. So I was not necessarily trying to tell people stop drinking, stop doing cocaine, stop. Because like, if you keep telling them stop this, stop that, they're going to keep doing it anyway. Or they say, oh, I can do it, Miss Cynthia, with God's help. That happened a lot too. And I will, and I'm going to be all right. But then they'll go back, oh, I slipped again. I backslid or what have you, you know. And I was more concerned about what was the road that got you here in the first place, you know. And a lot of times, again, it was these traumas that was happening, you know, back in their past that was never addressed. A lot of my patients, especially my trans patients, were abused as children. And then not accepted by their families because they came out as trans. and then had to go through chosen families and maybe even engaged in sex work because they can't get regular jobs. So, and then when they engaged in sex work, then they put sometimes their lives in danger because their customer, trying to use, not use their atypical words, but would sometimes turn very violent on them. One of my patients talked about, and I do apologize, my dog is in the background barking, so I do apologize, but
it's okay. Pets are welcome here.
Very good. Okay. Well, you know, great on Keita, because she does bark and makes her presence known even when we don't want it. I digress. But one of my patients who did sex work in order for them to augment their income would, I remember we talked about having, going through like one of the programs in order to help her get dentures because all her teeth were gone. And the reason being is because like one of her tricks knocked all of her teeth out because they decided that it was a great idea for them to rape her and also beat her up in the process. You know, this is something that happened more often than you want it to happen. And it goes back to this whole thing about not necessarily having a safe space for people to be in because they can't afford it. It's not there. We don't want to put aside the funding for it. We don't necessarily even want to keep the social contracts that we are making with people because they're still constituents. They're still citizens. They're still people. They're still human beings. Mm-hmm. But unfortunately, even though like we have like studies after studies after studies and people who have dedicated themselves to this work about exposing how widespread this issue is concerning like the lack of behavioral health and wraparound services, period, especially like in these communities, then they say, you know what, I don't necessarily know if I really want to allocate those funds in order for you to do that, you know. And it's sad, you know. So like, of course, like you're constantly going around trying to find that wraparound service for your client and trying to really, you know, be the conduit to get them attached to that service. But, you know, they're still very much so far and few in between. I can even think about, and even in Chicago, we had a huge hatchet job happen to behavioral health services right here in our city. And they got rid of a lot of group homes, a lot of organizations that actually even touted or offered trauma-informed care and harm reduction care were, you know, oh, your grants ran out, so we can't self-assist you anymore. And they were having difficulty getting that again. And then, you know, depending on who's in charge, okay, we got a grant for you again, but then like leadership decides to use it to give themselves 33% raises. Yes, I'm talking to you, executive leadership team. That's what you did during COVID, instead of actually putting it into the hands of people who are actually giving the care to the patients. Yeah, wow. That happens. So
that is unreal.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
Bureaucracy.
Yeah.
It's really gross.
Yeah. It is. But the thing about it is that the people who they are really egregiously harming the most are the ones who they say they want to help the most. You know, people who look like me. People who are also in other marginalized, historical marginalized communities, people who may even come here undocumented. They, you know, and even though, like, again, we take care of everybody who, regardless of their ability to pay, regardless of their immigration status, we're going to be here. And they have the money to do it, but I'm like, what are you doing with the money? I mean, because it's like, just because you say, okay, our bottom line does not necessarily match up for us to be able to do this. It doesn't necessarily mean that the care is not needed. The care is definitely needed, and it could actually cause like ripple effects in the community in order for, you know, people who desperately need the care and desperately need the resources to not be able to get it.
I was listening to a podcast today, on Behind the Bastards. They were talking about a specific cult leader. I can't remember the name right now, but they were talking on the issue of hunger. And instead of you really thinking about how, because only 1% of people really need money, like you can give just money or food to that. It is a logistics, it's a political problem. It's a logistical problem. It has many, many layers because people think that like, oh, we'll just feed people, but it has a lot of layers on that political public scheme and legally that for people to get access. And but they tell rich people to only think of like, wouldn't it feel really good if we ended hunger? And then they just throw money at it. Mm-hmm. They don't address the real problems of the logistics of it because it is very complicated. Because when you're in a place of privilege and you have money and access and things like that, you're not thinking about the logistics of how, because they're used to just throwing money at something and and problem solved.
Right.
But when you're dealing with bureaucracy and politics, it gets weird and fuzzy and you have to deal this type of stuff. So the fact that you're doing the groundwork and having to deal with those systems, you know, and being a person that doesn't have a lot of power, but there's power in the group, which I think is great. But it's still really frustrating when I hear about these things, because it just reminds me that everybody's concerned about the bottom dollar rather than what this is doing to actual people in their lives.
Right. Yeah. Well,
and I love, Cynthia, the way you framed this in kind of an intersectional way too, where you bring up the fact that, you know, people's, you know, different circumstances may kind of pile onto one another, you know, the more and more different kinds of disadvantages or ways of being marginalized that people have or are experiencing, the less likely they are to be able to access all of these things. Like Helen was saying, you know, the problem isn't that there's not enough food, it's that some people can't get access to it.
Right.
And if you're a member of a group that has all these different ways that you're being marginalized, then it's that much more difficult. So I love that you're addressing that in your work in a way that actually is, you know, meaningful to the people who need this the most. So thank you for doing that. And, you know, I wonder if you could talk a little bit more about that too, and kind of the ways that, you know, some of these different facets like racism can intersect with access to healthcare. And you mentioned earlier about social determinants of health.
Right.
Can you talk a little bit about what's going on there?
Sure. So I am going to bring up a bit of my soon to be published article on freedmanhealthandwellness.com. Make sure you read it.
Yes.
But
I will now that you told me to.
it should be up later on this evening. But but one of the things that I first did was make sure I defined social determinants of health, because that is a phrase that we hear a lot that, you know, a lot of people really don't know what it is. So when we're saying social determinants of health, we're talking about the conditions in which people are born, how they grow, they live, they work, and they age. And they include factors like socioeconomic status, education, neighborhoods and physical environments, employment and other social supports of networks, as well as access to healthcare. And if we look specifically at racism and how that affects these particular social determinants of health, then you can definitely see how racism is way beyond definition 1.0 of like bigotry just because of skin color. It's now embedded in the systems on how these particular things, like you mentioned before, access happens. You know, some of the things that I pulled up specifically about socioeconomic status, and I'm specifically talking about Black Americans, this is according to The Economist. The Black household, the mean Black household wealth is about $138,200, but for whites, that number is about $933,700. And this is, I believe that they're using statistics roughly around 2019, 2020. The medium wealth is even smaller, but even more so lopsided. The typical Black family has just about 17,100 compared to typical white one, which is about 171,000. And the discrepancies are even caused by low incomes and by debt compared, the discrepancies are caused by low incomes and by debt. And compared with whites, Black Americans have higher debt loads. 19.4% of Black households have a net wealth at or below $0, compared with 9.2% of whites. And they have even been slowed improvements over the decades. But the Great Recession of 2007 to 2008 wiped this out, since Blacks were disproportionately harmed by subprime mortgages, which blew up, which, you know, those particular lopsided mortgages where it had like an entry rate of maybe like 4 or 5%, but then doubled and tripled within 3 years. So a lot of Black people had to end up foreclosing on their homes, which also definitely contributed to the housing crisis at that time period. So because of that, now home ownership, and the which is a conventional way of building wealth in the middle class, stands at about 42% amongst Blacks, but and only 1% point higher than it was in 1968, compared with 73%, which is for whites. And we can even look specifically about specifically at policies that contributed to this, like redlining. This is a historic policy that was practiced by banks and other institutions of lending and insurance companies at the behest of the federal government, where they drew red lines around particular neighborhoods that were predominantly Black and say, we will not lend or insure there. So a lot of times we had infrastructures, houses, and other portions of Black people who couldn't even purchase a home, or they end up doing contract leasing. Contract leasing was even worse in Chicago. You had a bunch of Black folk that left the South at the turn of the century, right when Reconstruction was no more. And you start to see the Union soldiers that were in the South to start disappearing, and lynching started to become a thing, and Black towns and burning them down and putting them underwater also became a thing. So a lot of them fled to the North in order for them to start a new life, but they still experience racism in that particular area as well, where they were not able to, you know, build wealth because they weren't able to purchase homes. They weren't able to invest in their own neighborhoods. And then also we dealt with Jim Crow, which was the policy of separate but equal. But, you know, in 1954, the Supreme Court found that with Brown versus the Board of Education, which essentially got rid of segregation, that separate was not equal, because we just saw even in the education system alone that there were stark differences between Black children going to school versus white children going to school.
That's in my own county. It's happened in my own county.
But the thing about it is that legacy still haunts us to this day. And another social determinant of health is, even if we're talking about education, I pulled these particular statistics from the National School Boards Association. And they said in 2018, nearly one third of Black students lived in poverty, which is about 32%, compared to 10% of white students in families living in poverty. The percentage of Black students who lived in households where the highest level of education attained by either parent was a bachelor's degree or higher was 27%, compared with 69% of Asian students and 53% of white students. So 64% have parents whose education level was less than a high school diploma. 45% lived in a mother-only household, and 35% live in father-only households. And there's even another statistic that I believe I've seen from the Bureau of Labor Statistics. I heard it on NPR, that approximately 1 million families in America that are led by single mothers, specifically in the Black community, live at or below the federal poverty level. So this is going to affect even how, because like, of course, if you're living at the federal poverty line or below, you don't own a home. And historically, how do schools get funding? Through property taxes, which I really, really, really need to change. Because if you have an area like a white area where you have more homeowners, of course, you're going to have more property taxes that are going into the school system. You're going to have better schools, just opposed to a Black community where it is predominantly poor, predominantly renters instead of property owners. You're not going to get as much funding into their particular public schools. And they go on to say that long-term trends show even an achievement gap between Black and white students. About 9 out of 100 Black students perform at or above the NAEP proficiency level in civics. Only 13 out of 100 Black students perform at or above the NAEP proficiency level in math. And only about 15 out of 100 Black students perform at or above the NAEP proficiency level in reading. I remember in one of my previous inceptions of my life, I was a high school teacher and I taught music. Specifically, I did first studio technique, and then I moved on to teaching choir. And one of my colleagues was there teaching the students. That was my day off because I did another day. And he told me, hey, the other day I was printing off lyrics for a song that I wanted to teach to the choir. I said, oh, how did they do? And he said, well, I didn't print the lyrics. And I said, why not? He said, well, the secretary told me that when she saw me actually trying to print lyrics for the students, she said, what are you doing? And I said, I'm copying lyrics. And then she said, don't you know that most of your students cannot read?
What the fuck?
And
I
was like, that's news to me. I really wish I would have known this before taking the shop. And because I was teaching at an alternative school on the south side of Chicago. And I remember after the 5 minutes passed after my jaw was, lifted up from the floor, I was just like dumbfounded and awed. And so like every time that we taught, songs, we had to teach it, by rote. Which made it a little bit more difficult because I had like lofty goals. Like I wanted to teach, music reading. I wanted to teach like some keyboarding skills, like some of the stuff that I learned when I was taking music classes back in the day in piano that I knew, because like I had students who really wanted to, maybe pursue music education and also performance when they went to college, but it's going to be even difficult for them because they don't necessarily have the proficiencies in order for them to even get to college in the first place. And I just had one question. If they can't read, why are they in high school? And it was told to me because these students are forgotten and they're just pushed along.
Well, like I remember when I took a social psychology course when I was in college, and we had a discussion about the subtle differences people are treated. Like it's not, because we tend to think of racism as a society of like burning crosses and saying the N-word and, marginalizing people and that sort of thing. But it's like, I call the death of a thousand cuts. You see it in misogyny, you see it with queer people. Anyone that's a marginalized group is those little cuts. And one of the things we're talking about that Black students are treated less, even though you're in the same classroom, and they might be funded by the same organization. You have a couple of Black kids in a majority white classroom. They are treated less smart, less, and it's not, and the teacher's not even aware that they're doing it.
Yeah.
You know, but they're treated differently than the white students because there's this perception through priming and psychological manipulation that's happened within the country. And this is something that I had to do a deconstruction on myself too, that going like, oh, what I was taught was like absolute bullshit. But that was a deconstruction that I had to go through of this idea that different races have like different brains and their ability to learn, which really, no, it's the systematic oppression that says, yeah, exactly. No.
Yeah.
But
that's a no.
But that's one of the
historical anthropology gone wrong.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah,
exactly. And that was a discussion that we had in these classes about how these psychological inferences are taught even to people of color, that those little cuts happen with even the student doesn't think they're as smart, and it has nothing to do with their ability or their brain or them for learn. It's because the social psychology happens. That's a real problem, because now they're, because it's an authority figure and they're being treated differently than their white counterparts, which is very gross. Not a fan, but not like to happen.
And I mean, even when you talk about social psychology, that really has bled into like how racism is actually practiced, because we look at institutions and systems, it could even be to the point where if I'm talking to a Black student, I'm going to have these particular biases against them just because they're Black, because society has taught me Black people are this. And even like, and there's even differences on how like some teachers will even teach their children, even if they happen to be Black, versus like, say, for instance, if a Black person is an immigrant versus if they have been here for multiple generations. I remember reading a tweet from Candace Owens, not a fan, but you know, she brings some type of insight, where
she's a special lady.
Well, you know, special is something you would say, I would say something else, but I digress. She tweeted, that she was wanting to study why Black immigrants would fare better than Black Americans, you know, whether if it would be in the education system, in employment, in wealth, and home ownership, et cetera, et cetera. And the perception is because when Black immigrants come to the United States, they just, you know, they just outwork Black Americans, and they just happen to be smarter, and they have this innate sense of hustle mentality, and they'll do whatever it takes in order for them to achieve the American dream based on meritocracy. And that's bullshit. It has nothing to do with you have an innate sense of go-get-itness versus the next person. But if you're looking at these social determinants of health and how racism historically has been practiced in these particular communities, then of course you're going to see an achievement gap. Of course you're going to see a housing gap. Of course you're even going to see health disparities, because your neighborhood, if it's crumbling and you don't necessarily have the proper infrastructure, you live in a food desert, there's no parks, your sidewalks are not safe, crime is high. I mean, the last thing that you want to do is say, gee, I feel like taking a walk this evening because it's such a fine day. Like, no, I'm not going outside because I might get shot. These are, you know, things that, you know, Black Americans would consider more so than anything else when they're just leaving their homes, and more so than any other race. When we look at employment, like the highest, right now, Black unemployment as of 2021 was at 8.6%, higher than every race and ethnicity in the United States. And it's like, I mentioned this in a couple of speeches I did, one that I did for the Women of Color Beyond Belief Conference, and also one that I did for Houston Oasis, that Black Americans are at the bottom of every social and economic status, except for one, our God belief. And, you know, even like when we're talking about support systems, which is another determinant of health, that historically the biggest support system that African Americans had was the church. But the second highest support system is the family. But the family in of itself has even been decimated because of racism, institutional racism, that has really decimated socioeconomic statuses amongst this group of people. And I even remember reading, I don't know if it was in Black Enterprise or another particular magazine, how they predicted, and this is before COVID, that Black wealth in America was going to be below $0 in 2053. And it got sped up. Some economists say it's going to be at 20, and that zero below $0 is going to happen in 2030. And a lot of times it's because we're still not doing the necessary things to really address these social determinants of health that disproportionately affect Black Americans in the adverse. And the thing about it is that this is exactly what Dr. King was actually marching and organizing against. He was really, you know, like I hear a lot when people would bring up his speeches, they always go to the I Have a Dream speech. And the Christian right loves to bring up the I remember when he said, I want my children to be judged not for the color of their skin, but the content of their character. And that's all well and good. But, you know, the reason why we got here is because race was based on the color of the skin and then got baked into our institutions that we're still living under this legacy to this day. So we can't escape that whole judgment call if it rules every portion of my life and we don't necessarily have the proper backing to get rid of it. You know, when we're talking about racism, white supremacy, this is an institution that was invented by European landowners back in the 1600s after Nathaniel Bacon's riots against the Virginia crop plantation. What did they grow? Tobacco owners.
My husband knows a lot about that. Growing up in Virginia, and his dad used to pick tobacco. Mm-hmm. Besides, like other Black people, mm-hmm. but that were making less money than he was because he was white.
Yeah,
and the exact same fucking job.
You're doing the exact same job. And the crazy thing about it is, like, even before, like, a lot of these particular laws that came down from Virginia, I believe it's the House of Burgess, that really, you know, started to cement race and how it's treated in America before we even had the United States. Indentured servants and slaves were treated the same. There was no difference. They was all fucked over by their landlords. And they were, you know, so it wasn't until we put this myth in place that, hey, poor white person, you can achieve everything that I have as a rich white person if you just buy into the system. But this is the crazy thing. Poor whites couldn't even vote until 1865. Same times that Black people who actually got emancipated.
If you did not own land,
you could not own
a vote.
You had to be a white landowner.
Yeah, you have to have a penis.
Yeah,
that's the most important thing. Yeah, you have to have a penis.
You have to have that, you know. But you still have poor whites buy into the system. I can be that someday. I can, and it still is prevalent to this day. Like, you know, I remember the guy who was in all the news now, the Andrew Tate character person. And
he is, oh, but his comeuppance is so, so sweet.
Yeah.
I'm just gonna relish it. Don't ruin it for me. I won't.
But like, one of the reasons why he gained so much popularity is because he is touting this whole thing like, I'm rich. And you should do the things that I do so you can be rich too. But, you know, people who actually follow his formula of richness, which I have yet to actually see how anybody can duplicate this and actually stay legal, would not be able to obtain.
He created an MLM system for people to promote his own bullshit because he got knocked off all the social medias for being a fucking misogynist and a terrible human being.
Yeah.
So he developed an MLM scheme to like get laid, even though he's like king of the incels, which is counterintuitive when you really think about it.
But the thing about it is that Andrew didn't do anything but copy the same type of system bullshit that, you know, that we've all have witnessed. He just did it to enrich himself. I mean, like, how he really got rich is that he exploited women on webcams. He said that's how he basically human trafficked himself. He was a pimp and got rich off of that and then started saying stupid things on the internet.
And it's funny that the white supremacists are defending him now. Isn't that funny?
Yeah, it really is. And you know, and he happens to be a mixed race who's actually originally from the south side of Chicago.
And he's Muslim. He claims to be Muslim. Like,
yeah, he claims to be Muslim now, but he used to be atheist. Did you know that?
No, I didn't. I know he was Muslim. And I didn't know he was a former atheist.
Yeah, he was a former atheist. He converted to being Muslim, even though I cannot see him praying five times a day. I just can't see that. Praying to himself.
I can't see him praying twice.
I don't.
He's like a Muslim that like Trump is a Christian.
as long as it's convenient, very a lot of cherry picking, you know, but yeah, it's so it's kind of interesting, like, you know, how like these particular things like this keep on showing up over and over and over again. And even King was trying to really break through that to say that, hey, poor whites, you actually have more in common with downtrodden Negroes than you do the establishment, the elitist establishment. And we was like, they were like, no, we don't. Some people got it, but unfortunately not enough. So it's we're still dealing with the haves and the have nots. We're still dealing with, you know, the owners versus the workers. You know, we're still dealing with that. But when it comes down to the bare brass knuckles of all of it, you know, I remember reading, and especially like when COVID really became like hit the fan, when America catches a cold, Black people catch a flu, you know, because like we're going to feel it worse because systems were just set up that way that we're going to feel it worse. You know, I mean, like even like healthcare disparities, racism actually running rampant into that because doctors have this notion that has been touted for centuries that Black people don't feel pain. I remember
you have thicker skin than I do, Cynthia. Yeah, that's how it works.
Okay, not last time I checked. You know, I look crazy and I get a bruise. You know, but with these particular notions, then it's going to bleed into systems on how, you know, Black people are going to even like experience health, right? So like if they're going to, we still have a higher mortality rate. We still have, you know, less access to healthcare systems that are viable. Even like where I used to work, one of the reasons why we had a 30,000 patient population, mostly with LGBTQ people and especially Black folk, is because they couldn't get the fair treatments in the traditional hospitals. So they came to us because we provided not only primary care, but we also provided, you know, staff that can address, you know, sexual trauma. And we also provided substance use recovery assistance. And we also, you know, help with case management and behavioral health service, like all these different things that needs to be addressed in order for a person to be healthy. And even if we couldn't do it, we actually had a whole referral team that can get people attached to other healthcare systems so they can get the treatment that they needed, especially if they had a specialty comorbidity. So these are the things that even King was trying to address and shine the light on, like, hey, this is an issue. And especially when I read that home ownership actually went further down from 1968 to now, I'm like, what in the hell are we doing? You know, it's sad that we're still like having these conversations over and over again. And you know, shout out to King. I believe that he really was a political genius. You know, he wasn't just about marching and saying nonviolence. I mean, he used television to market how Negroes were being treated in the United States so it can like spread all over the world. Next thing you know, you have Russian television picking up what's happening in the South and in places like Chicago, where, you know, Black folk are getting hosed just because they're sitting at a counter where it's segregated, a lunch counter where it's segregated, or if they're going into like a waiting area that's considered white only, or any of these things, or even just marching because they want to have equal opportunity and equal rights to whites. So they're seeing this, and then next thing you know, we need to do something about this, because like if the Russians get involved, you know, the USSR might get like some of these other African countries to come on their side instead of being on our side, which we are democracy driven, you know. And like it was all about the whole Red Scare, and even Dr. King knew about that, who I just found out last night was a socialist. Ooh, shout out to Dr. King.
Did know that. I knew that before you did.
Yes, I didn't know that. I didn't know. I kind of figured.
Thank you, NPR. Figured,
right. Yeah.
I found out through NPR because I'm better than you.
Yeah. I was like, well, but you were right. But yeah, I mean, but like, according to like some of his policies, especially like if you read one of his last books, Where Do We Go From Here? From Chaos to Community. And he was really talking about ramping up socialist programs specifically to do mass transfers of money and resources into Black communities in order for them to be viable. I mean, he was talking about billions and billions of dollars, because like he said, it was policy and legislation that helped whites become middle class and also wealthy. And it's going to take policy and legislation for that for a repair module to happen to African Americans. And this is even part of like some of the advocacy that I do, besides just trying to help even build community around atheism for, you know, people who look like me, but also say that our issues, like King said, the answer is a political one. Mm-hmm. If we don't, and you can't even talk about the social determinants of health without really addressing the politics that goes behind it, because it was politics that caused the healthcare disparities and the education disparity and the housing disparity and the income disparity and the wealth disparity. And need I go on? You know, that's what it was. Like, it was legislation, practice, and politics that did all of that. So legislation, practice, and politics is going to have to fix it. And part of that is actually tearing down the system of racism, white supremacy, and how it's baked into our institutions.
I was just gonna say, I really love how you broke that down and just illustrated how, you know, that racism is baked into so many of these social institutions that affect us in everyday life. And I was really interested in the point you kind of hinted at earlier about, you know, religion is another one of those social institutions that, yes, you know, is kind of one of the waters that we swim in. Mm-hmm. And it's been connected with, you know, some of the forms of social advocacy and movements for civil rights. And you mentioned it as, you know, a source of community for Black folks. But how does religious belief or non-belief play into this struggle for people?
You know, I'm glad you asked that question, because it kind of goes back to this whole thing about, do you need religious organization in order for you to garner community. Mm-hmm. And I would say, no, you don't. I understand that, you know, and this is even like some of like the debates that I've had within the community about, you know, are keeping faith-based organizations, especially being so integral in our social makeup, important? And I'm like, it doesn't have to be that way. The only reason why it continues is because we let it. You know, we have to also recognize that there is a large falling away, especially with the millennials and Gen Z, from church. And a lot of that has come from scandals and from trauma that people have absolutely had happen to them while they were in the church. And also, because knowledge about the way that our world works, especially the natural world, check out that song on Godless Gospel, The Natural World, that is a song of ours. I digress, I'm coming back.
You pimp your shit all you want, Cynthia. Go ahead.
All right. As a matter of fact, when we debuted, Mandisa actually led that song. So again, shout out to Mandisa Thomas. But as we gain more knowledge about our world that's around us, and how every time that we attributed a God to whatever we thought ruled us or what have you, and say, oh no, we actually have a natural explanation for that. Like I remember my partner told me, and I did not know this, that Egyptians back in the day used to think that anal sex caused earthquakes. And
I did not know that.
I did neither.
That's wild. That's awesome. It's hilarious and awesome all at the same time.
If you do it right, the earth moves and the sky tumbles down. I tell you, you know. But like a lot of this stuff was like tied into like religious belief, you know. But then, like, of course, we found out no, that's like, you know, tectonic plates actually shifting, and the earth is burping because like the earth has gas. Go figure, you know. So as the more that we are learning about our world and universe, we see more so that natural explanations start to replace the supernatural explanations, right? So like all these particular things are culminating, and like we have a rise in skepticism and people asking questions, and even in my own personal falling away of being a Christian was that, you know, I had too many questions that my elders could not answer. And a lot of times I was told, well, you need to pray more.
Are you being uppity, Cynthia? Are you being uppity?
Right. You're one of those uppity people who think you know things. So you have the nerve to ask questions. How dare you? You know, a lot of times, and even like you'd still have preachers to this day that's also using the argument like we need the church because the church helped us organize. But little known history fact is that when the civil rights movement was happening, and you know, Dr. King was organizing, actually you had more Black churches that was against him that was for him, you know. So like this whole thing like you need the church to organize is absolutely fallacious. No, you don't. You just need a critical mass of people that says enough is enough, and we just need to go ahead and work this out. So we also have to address the elephant in the room with community, because unfortunately, religion does community better than atheists. They just do. I'm sorry, y'all, but they do, you know. And the only
right. Carl and I had a conversation about this earlier this week about how the atheist community is failing marginalized group. And whether you're queer or you're female or you're a person of color, a lot of atheism is still white male driven, and it is a fucking problem.
Exactly. I remember, and I said that even like when we did our Black activism panel at the Recovering, I'm sorry, from Freedom From Religion Foundation's convention, mm-hmm. where I said that this world that we are in is largely pushed by cisgender white men, you know, and like people who look like myself are not as seen, you know. I'm glad that we're seeing more, you know, people who happen to be minorities that are coming up and actually stepping up and having their voice heard from the secular community. It's about goddamn time. But you know, we're still overshadowed by, you know, cishet white men, and which has been the case forever.
Like, so. You and I were talking earlier this week, I need to expand my social circle, because you and Mandisa are only the two mm-hmm. women of color I know that are promoting atheism and skeptical thought from that point of view. Mm-hmm. It is because it is so driven by white male atheists. And mm-hmm. Carr and I were talking about, like, can we think of any queer, you know, them and myself, can we think of any queer people mm-hmm. that are at the forefront? There's a few popular YouTubers we can think of, but there's really it's all white male dominated. Mm-hmm. And it's very frustrating, because I want everybody to have a space at the table. And when you can't have, it's just like, well, it's like Congress, you know, you only have a certain percentage of people that are the outliers. When you look at it, it's an old boys club.
Right.
And it's very frustrating.
I think that, like, but one of the things that we do have to realize is that even like people who happen to be from like historically marginalized community, like Black folks, even Latinx folks, are still highly religious, you know?
Right.
I think that, you know, the Black community right now, according to Pew, sits at 79-80% Christian, you know, that profess to be Christian.
I work for a Black Christian company, like the mm-hmm. company I work for is Black owned, and they are very Christian. They were to listen to Joel Osteen, and I was just like, yo.
And you like,
no, what?
And I,
what?
And you know, I want to say, so did you know that they found $160,000 behind a wall in his bathroom at the time?
Right, exactly. You know? Exactly. Like, did you know,
want to listen to one of them corny dad jokes that he tells every morning on Sunday? You want to do that? Okay, cool. All right, well, I just want to know where your head was at, you know? But we still deal with this pie in the sky before you die. And it's still very much so ingrained in our culture to garner iconography and religion. Like, and I even think of myself, again, being a person of a certain age, that it took me a long time to come out of religion. You know, I was like in my 40s when that happened, and a lot of it, and I did a lot of like circling different areas and trying this and doing that and things that and because like I just got to the point when I was in my 30s that I said that, you know, Christianity is not really servicing me any longer. But a lot of times I kept that to myself because the majority of my friends were Christian, and if I start talking like that around them, you know, I probably would have been slathered with oil and somebody tried to cast a demon out of me, you know? So they said, that ain't nothing but the devil. Oh, you know, like, oh, whoa, why are you coming at me with olive oil? So anyway, you know, is it extra virgin? Just checking. But anyway,
it's very important.
That's one to cook with. It is the best one to cook with.
Right. Can I make pesto with this later?
That's right.
But even with that, you still have like a lot of Black folk that I really believe are questioning their faith. They're questioning, you know, being in church. They're questioning even like giving tithes and offering and all these different things that they do, but they don't necessarily have as many outlets to really ask those questions. I'm so grateful to the Black non-believers that they do provide that space, but majority of the times that is the first thing that people will say, well, there's the Black non-believers, right? And I mean, right. Shout out, but you know, But we do need more areas in Black secularism that could actually foster community, so that, you know, people who happen to be part of these institutions can have a way for them to come out without being shamed for it.
So do you think, like, we touched on mental health within the Black community, and also that, like, you have to bury it. Do you, like, we see this all the time. It doesn't matter what religion you're in, that the intersectionality between mental health and religion, that your God is going to fix it for you, you know? And I have to imagine, you know, that there's also this thing, like, you have to be a strong person of color, that you don't need mental health care. You don't need, you know, that, because we don't want to, we want to put on a face of bravery. Yeah. And if you admit that you're vulnerable, then you're just giving, you know, power to the whiteies, you know, kind of idea, you know. Yeah. And I have to imagine that intersection, that those ideas get infected into, because, like, I know as a feminist, that if I show any sort of weakness from that perspective, and I show that, like, you know, obviously I want to abolish the patriarchy because it's bad for everybody. It's bad for everybody. But if I show a vulnerability, somehow I'm a weak female. So I have to imagine that gets infected into those into communities that you're involved in as well.
Oh my gosh, that is so appropriate. There is a newer word or phrase that's coming out called misogynoir, where it's specifically talking about the misogyny and patriarchy that that's oppressed Black women, because we're forced to take on the shoulders of the entire community and ourselves, our children, our partners, our jobs, our livelihoods. Like, you know, we have to carry all of it and put up a brave face. And so this whole thing that's constantly touted with strong Black women, you're a strong Black woman, you're a strong Black woman. And it's only as of late that I embrace being vulnerable, because I felt that for a very long time, I have to be this stature of fortitude, of Blackness, for womanhood everywhere, because the man ain't gonna bring me down. You know, but I'm still realizing now, and I have to constantly remind myself, I'm a human being, and I cannot shoulder every problem that's affecting my entire community. I don't have the width for that. You know, the only thing that I can do is my part. You know, so, like, and that would be my advocacy, you know, politically, healthcare wise, and even, like, you know, helping with, you know, building community, and also connecting with other like-minded individuals who want to, or who actually recognize that we do need to do advocacy work and organize and things of that nature. So, but no, not one person can do this. And it's okay that, you know, if I need to step back and just, if I need a mental break, then that's what I'm going to do. I am embracing naps, you know, like and it was so funny. My mom was messing with me the other day, because I was trying to get rid of my kid. And, so the Lovely Power Company decided that they needed to do some repair work. And so, like, we, without warning, like, our power was shut off for a few hours. And I remember I got a text message as this was going to happen, but they sent me a text message before and nothing ever happened. So I just thought that they were just going to do the repair work, but it's not going to necessarily affect our lives or anything. So, you know, next thing you know, poosh, everything is out. And I'm like, it's going to get cold in here because we can't turn anything on. I can't open up the refrigerator or freezer. I can't cook anything because, you know, electricity's out. So I'm like, I need to send this kid somewhere. And so I eventually sent him, I took him to my nephew's house with my other niece so that they can hang out. And then I ended up like coming back to the house. By the time I came back to the house, the lights were back on. And then I went to go get them, but they told me get them later. But my mom was like, so you're going to dump your picnic off on somebody, my mom's Jamaican, you're going to dump your picnic off on somebody else's house? No. I said, yes, yes, that's exactly what I'm going to do. And I don't feel bad about it. I mean, because at night, you know, I have to watch him. I got to
make sure. Takes a village, girl.
Yeah, it does. It does. Right. I mean, like, you know, like I've never been a parent. And again, I'm 40s, trying to raise a 1 year old. I mean, like, what the hell is this? So, you know, when I get a chance to rest, that's exactly what the hell I'm going to do, because I know that I carry a lot. And I've always been a person that, you know, wanted to, you know, be busy. I don't like to stay idle. And I always wanted to be a person that helped. But I had a supervisor who told me a couple years ago that you cannot pour from an empty cup.
Right. I had someone tell me that too back in high school. And I also, like, I had a therapist tell me, like, I had to give 3 compliments of myself. She's like, give me 3 compliments of yourself that does not serve others. And that I got like one down, and it took me a week to think of 2 more. Right?
Yeah. I mean, because even if you think about it, as women, we are taught that we are the nurturers. And so we find our worth in how we serve. How we serve our children, how we serve our partners, how we serve our workplace, how we serve our families. Like that's where our value for some reason actually lies, instead of us just having value in just being us, you know? And unfortunately, because that's not something that's touted in society, that has to be learned. And a lot of us don't necessarily get it until, you know, much later in life that.
I had a therapist to point it out. So I had to really think about it. I got it. I got there. Because I think also too, when you get into a certain woman of age, that you've got it all figured out. And I'm like, well, I figured it out. I'm an independent person. And then when someone challenges you, you're like, oh fuck. Like now I have to think about it and do the work. And to deconstruct that, it's hard.
Yeah.
And I want to say, Cynthia, thank you so much for being here. I am like you are my favorite people, and I've been excited about this all day because you're so intelligent and so well-spoken, and you get me thinking about different ideas that I hadn't really thought about before. That helps me become a better person. So I want to say thank you, because I say I love you, and I don't mean that flippantly, because I do love you because of the work that you do and the fact that you're very well-spoken and you're an advocate and you do the hard work. So that's why I love you. And thank you so much for being here. I'm so appreciative. So
thank you, Helen. I'm gushing. I'm blushing. I know you can't really see it, but
I know.
Thank you. No, I do love you too, and I thank you so much for inviting me. You know, I'm glad to do it.
I want you and Mendeza to do a talk together.
Yes, let's do like that.
I want that so bad.
Consider yourselves invited. Yeah. We're getting you on the calendar.
Yeah. Right. Well, you know, Mendeza, I know you're in the chat. I'm still down.
I want you, Mendeza.
Yeah, that would be amazing.
And her gym. Yes. I'm going to go to the gym and get it ass. Both of you to do a talk together.
Yes. And Cynthia, yes, thank you so much for, I know that, you know, this is work too, coming on here and educating people about this topic that, you know, more people are ignorant about than should be. And that's not your job to educate people. And we really do truly appreciate you taking the time to come and bring this up and let us know as a community of, you know, some of the concerns that are going on and ways that we can be thinking about being a better community and a more inclusive community. So thank you so much for that.
Thank you for having me.
Yeah. And let's go to Q&A now. Unless, do you have anything else you want to share before we move to questions?
No, we can do Q&A. Q&A. Yeah.
All right. And I definitely want to share some of the resources and links that you brought as well. So don't let me forget to do that after we go through some questions. Okay, so let's see. We have a handful of questions here. And if anybody has a question that they haven't put in the chat yet that you want to ask Cynthia, go ahead and drop them in the chat now. And we'll collect those. We'll just be reading them off now, but after we go to the Hangout, you'll be able to unmute and discuss. Okay, one question that we got was, someone was wondering about, you mentioned earlier on in the talk, when you were talking about there not really being a need to be involved in a religious community in order to have community and do advocacy. And you mentioned that there were many churches that were even opposed to Dr. King's work. And someone was asking, why did or do churches oppose that?
That's a good question. And I think it's a multifaceted answer. I can only, in my case, I'm going to speak from my own personal experience. Unfortunately, I don't have a study on this that I can just pull up right now about why churches do this. But, you know, I think that one of the things that we must acknowledge that specifically here in the United States, It was mostly the white church that was a spearhead to really double, triple down on the justification of chattel slavery in the United States. And they did it using the Bible, you know? So when we saw more Christian organizations, Black churches like the AME and the AME Zion churches being one of the first Black institutions in the United States to show up in the late 18th, early 19th centuries. There was this, the doctrine mostly was, and also taught to slaves that if you just do your work here, then you're going to receive your reward in heaven. And a lot of times, I don't know if like some people are like familiar with the slave Bible, which was basically an annotation of the Bible that took out all the scriptures that could be considered liberation. Like most of the Old Testament is gone, especially Exodus. And, you know, because like specifically the story about the Hebrews being able to be led out of bondage from Egypt and like other and a lot of Paul's epistles, especially in Ephesians and Corinthians, where he says, slave, obey your masters as it is fit in the Lord. And even talking about like being a servant specifically from Jesus's gospels were often highlighted more so than any type of like garnering of liberation that you can think of. So the only thing that I can really think of is that I really believe, and history and experience in history only teaches me this, is that a lot of times like religion, especially with Christianity, pushes more so docility than it does like radical liberation. And a lot of times, especially the way that it was taught to us, was don't rock the boat. Like, you know, you're gonna piss the white people off. Why are you trying to do organize and do different things? They're gonna lynch you, they're gonna do this, they're gonna do that. You know, we need to be over here, you know, to sing songs of Zion, and we're gonna die, and then you know, Jesus is gonna meet us at the pearly gates and everything is gonna be okay, you know. But the thing about it is that we don't have a majority take on making sure that we are cared for here while we're in this life, because we don't know any other life other than the ones that we're living right now. If a person talks about dying and coming back by, you know, reincarnation, that's myth. You know, that that's part of mythos of, you know, Buddhism and Hinduism that has bled into like, you know, natural culture or what have you, in crystals and things of that nature. And we don't have like any empirical evidence to support that we're going to actually meet this beautiful life if we live a sin-free existence. I know that Kat Kerr talks a lot about riding roller coasters in heaven, and you can pet animals that are considered wild and they will absolutely be your friend, but I'm wondering what she's smoking. But anyway,
I'm not touching a bear, girl. And I'm doing it. I'm not going to go pet a bear.
Right. I ain't doing it either. You know what I'm saying? So, I mean, these are, so even though like this is stuff that is constantly touted that this is going to happen, it's like always an emphasis on heaven, always an emphasis on, you know, the end of times, and you know, like, I also believe that, like, you know, especially in Catholicism, and like these the newer Christians have like this sick fantasy about Jesus coming back and just smiting shit, you know, like, I'm like, are you okay? These are the questions I really want to ask them. You need to call Recovering from Religion and getting to the secular therapy project, because something's wrong. But right, yeah,
this is very spiteful.
I'm concerned.
I'm like, you know, dude, slow your roll.
Right.
Slow your roll, man.
I'm very much so concerned for you right now. But yeah, I mean, all these particular inceptions, you know, have come up over the years, especially when we're talking about like liberation. And I know that like we had like a portion of liberation theology and liberation doctrine that has been something that started to be preached in the 50s and 60s, especially during the civil rights movement. And then, you know, and even more so when you may have like a handful of Black churches that may have embraced like the Black Power movement, but you had a whole lot of them that opposed them too. So it's a catch-22 situation. Like, I don't like living under the oppression, but I don't want to rock the boat either, because mama and them gonna get mad and Jesus and them gonna get mad. And so since I don't want mama and them and Jesus and them to get mad, I'm just gonna go ahead and just stay right here and just take it and call it the day. But you know, it has to be to a point where you get sick and tired of being sick and tired. You know, and I know that was how it was for me. And I'm very grateful that I found other people who look like me, who are part of my community, that felt the same way. And we just kind of just like, you know, coalesce around one another. And one of the things that I have found specifically, that people who may even be of the mind where they want to liberate themselves from religion and theism and God belief, I have found a lot of them also support social movements, social justice movements, and bringing a sense of normalcy and humanism to our society. You know, so a lot of times I'm like, well, shit, like if we can agree on those particular things, then we can work this thing out and we can organize, and we don't necessarily always need a church to do it. Now, will that stop me from working with somebody who's a Christian? No. I work with Christians all the time, you know, as far as like when it comes to just social justice work. So, you know, that's not going to keep me from, I mean, and I know that, of course, like since you have a bunch of Black people that are still religious, but still also want to buck against the system, then of course our efforts are going to have to be coalesced in order for us to push the envelope forward. But, you know, but as far as like saying that that's absolutely necessary for us to have it to see social and economic change, no, it's not.
Like, you brought up a really good point, because I was listening to NPR because I'm better than you. But there was a particular Black person that is pro-life, but from a Black perspective, where a lot of advertising of pro-choice propaganda, which it is, mm-hmm. even though I'm a pro-choice person, towards the Black community. Mm-hmm. And she was like, maybe we should be focusing on like employment, equal opportunity housing, you know, being part of a social network that will support us. Because even though she was pro-life, she was talking about the social issues that marginalize people within her community. And I was like, listen, I'm like, we can debate about abortion, but the fact that you're talking about equal opportunity for people, I want to work, I would rather work with someone than that. Like that, then work for someone that says that, like, you know, only certain groups get certain access to certain things.
Right.
You know, yeah.
I would too. I mean, because like, even when we're talking about the abortion debate, and last statistic that I saw that, you know, before Roe v. Wade was gutted, that, you know, one of the biggest groups percentage wise that took advantage of abortion were Black women. But one of the things that, you know, and some people would say, especially like, you know, some who happen to be conservative, that, you know, well, they're just using that to use as birth control. And, but the thing about it is like, I forgot which study it was called, the, I'm so upset that I can't remember the study. I think it was the turnover.
You're gonna end this podcast and then you're gonna remember it. When we're done. It's just like
at 3 o'clock in the morning and wake up my my baby.
Is it Turnaway?
Turnaway. Thank you. Yes, okay. The Turnaway study. Thank you. Where, you know, they actually were able to have like a bunch of different women and people who had uteruses who had abortions, and also, you know, got into like a lot of the reasons why they were getting abortions. And the majority of it is because of economic reasons. I just can't afford a child. And then like some people are like, well, there's Medicaid and there's All Kids and there is food stamps and blah, blah, blah. And you can get all these services.
But they don't want to pay for the food stamps because then you're taking advantage of the systems. You're not pulling yourself up by your bootstraps. So you're taking advantage of it, blah, 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 blah.
And then you turn into the welfare queen and you're turning to me. And next thing you know, you're going to be a guest on Jerry Springer, all this other shit. So like, so again, it comes to catch 22. You're damned if you do, if you're damned if you don't, you know, and absolutely having a conversation around access to, you know, making sure that you have a viable wage and employment and housing and food and education and all the things is absolutely paramount. But it still would not say, okay, well, now that we address these things, we can completely just get rid of choice. Like, no, because that is a health choice that I am making for myself. And the only person that has the wherewithal to make that decision properly is me, between me and my doctor. That's it. That's it. And if I don't necessarily want to be an incubator for 9 months, so that's me.
You're exactly. Yeah, bodily autonomy. That's a thing.
Yes, exactly.
Yes. I love it. And on that note, happy positive note, we should probably start wrapping up so we can get you out of here on time. But I want to give you a chance to let people know where they can find you and share any links and resources that I can drop in the chat.
Yes. So I do have a link tree, so you can go ahead and drop that. That is basically the links to all Cynthia, you know. And also that's my social media, that's my writings, that's some of my YouTube experience appearances and the nine. So you know, that's there. And of course, and also my blog, freedmanhealthandwellness.com, which, you know, again, talks about the social determinants of health. I talked a lot, I blogged a lot during the height of COVID, because COVID was such a revealer of how systemic and institutional racism is like very much so alive in our society today. So I have a bunch of different articles talking about that. And And yeah, and also I believe this weekend I will be a guest on In the Cut, which is from Black Nonbelievers. Mandisa Thomas is going to be doing an interview, and I believe that I will be on with another person. I believe that their name is Mary, but that normally premieres, I want to say 12 Central. That's what I want to say. Mandy's, if you're still here, just drop the time that
she's not premieres. Yes.
Yeah, Central. <it's laughs> Okay, great, cool. So I'll be a guest there, and definitely going to be, and if you're in the Chicago area who happens to be a Black, who's atheist, agnostic, or an ally, we are relaunching the Black Nonbelievers affiliate in Chicago. So we are doing our first meetup at Sip and Savor in Hyde Park. So if you go up to meet up and, you know, just put in, you know, Black Nonbelievers Chicago, that's a particular group should come up, join it. And yeah, meet us for coffee and conversation. It's going to be just like a real chill environment where, you know, we can start to like rebuild the community that happens to be there. And, you know, more events and things of that nature is going to come. We have like a few things that's like turning in my head that, you know, that we can do. Made a couple of contacts for other different events for Black Nonbelievers and also for social and political advocates to be able to participate in. So yeah, I'll be posting a lot of that stuff, especially on Twitter and Facebook. So please follow me and you'll get all the alls.
Excellent. That is super exciting. That sounds like a really great event. I'm looking forward to that too. So definitely going to be checking that out. And I will drop in the chat. Also, you listed a few book recommendations for people. Mm-hmm. And I tell you what, I am a big fan of book recommendations.
Yes.
I drive a lot for work and I listen to audiobooks. And so I'm always looking for more. So I'm adding these to my list and I'm going to drop these in the chat too, if that's
cool.
All right.
Cool. Yes, please, please, please. Yeah. Especially like, you know, since I am I'm a big advocate for reparations and for slavery descendants and the first book that I actually posted, From Here to Equality, Black Reparations in the 21st Century by Eric Kirsten Mullen and Dr. William Darity, is an absolute you gotta read it, you know, because like he makes the case historically, empirically, and also talks about how it can be done tenably. Yeah, check that out. But yeah, the other books that I've also recommended, especially when we're talking about health disparities and how we got here historically by medical apartheid. Yeah, really, it's a book that I had to kind of like read and then put down. And read and put down because it, you know, you get mad. And also Ibram Kendi's A Stamp from the Beginning. Definitely it's a long, big book.
Yes, it is.
Be warned.
I have that one on my shelf and I keep setting it back and reading something else ahead of it because it's so long, but I need to just tackle it. It's time for me to read that one.
but it has such great information in it and basically kind of how we like build the foundations of race and racism even before, you know, Europeans started to come to the New World. So one of the things that he talks about in the book is how Europeans were writing books and pamphlets about Africa and never been there.
Yeah,
you know, like, you know, very, very, very much so sowing the foundation of a lot of these propagandized stereotypes that we still deal with today. And I was like, what? I had to kind of like ponder on it. I said, so they were actually making stuff up about Africans and they never touched the continent. That was insane to me.
But, facts are optional, apparently.
Yeah, okay. Kellyanne Conway's alternative facts.
Excellent. Well, we will definitely check out those books. I cannot wait to add those to my ever-growing list.
Yes. Yes.
All right.
Recovering from Religion is a nonprofit organization whose mission it is to provide hope, healing, and support to those struggling with issues of doubt and non-belief. Hope, healing, and support is waiting for you on our website, recoveringfromreligion.org. There you can speak or chat with a trained agent who will work with you through your struggles and doubts or to help find resources that may work for you. You can also find local Recovering from Religion support groups in your area for the long-term recovery work. Resources specifically curated for those struggling with doubts, disbelief, and trauma can also be found on the RFR website. To connect with a secular therapist in your area, go to seculartherapy.org and create an account. If you'd like to support the work that RFR does, you can donate or sign up as a volunteer on the Recovering from Religion website. It's also a big help subscribing to the RFR YouTube channel, our blog, or following us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. Questions, comments, and suggestions can be emailed to us at rfrx@recoveringfromreligion.org. Thanks for tuning in, and we hope you'll be with us next time on the Recovering from Religion podcast.